land use. It is April 13th, 2005, and we'll pretty well stick to the schedule that we have. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3314. Sam?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3314 is one which will allow the governor of the state to waive land use statutes and regulations if the governor finds the existence of an economic emergency. And an economic emergency is defined as owing to high unemployment, low economic growth rates, or low job growth rates that exist in a particular area of the state. And so it is the intent of the bill that then the governor's authority to waive the land use regulations could then be a stimulus for local economy.
Thank you, Sam.
I don't know what fool would have sponsored this bill. It was me, folks. That's why I'm saying that. We do have a... everyone, there's four people signed up to testify on this bill, all against it. And we have a letter from the governor that I'm going to ask Sam to read into the record.
Very briefly, the letter from Michael Carey of the governor's natural resources policy director has expressed concerns about the bill, and I think in summation, third paragraph, first sentence, I think sums it up. As a matter of policy, it is not in the state's best interest to grant so much authority to the governor or any individual to determine when the state laws will apply or not and to whom. That's basically, I think, the gist of the letter.
So the effort to make the Governor King is probably not going to go very far today, folks. But the four folks that signed up to speak against the bill would certainly like to hear your opinions. So we'll call Charlotte Leon, the mayor of Wilsonville, and Alex McPhail, please.
Chair Gerard and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you again today on the issue of industrial land expansion. House Bill 3314 has been referred to as an industrial supersiding bill, and while it is perhaps not as heavy-handed as the ill-conceived prison supersiding bill, it has at least as much potential for misuse, including the disregard of local government plans and the desires of local communities. Rather than streamlining processes, it is likely to result in time delays and added expenses for all concerned. I speak with some authority on this because I know that there is no other elected official in the state of Oregon with more experience and intimate knowledge about supersiding than me, and having been through it. One of the problems that we've been told that this is trying to solve is the lack of shovel-ready land for industry, but as I pointed out to you last week, the problem for most cities, including Wilsonville, is not the lack of land, but the lack of infrastructure to serve it. And the second problem we've been told that we might be trying to solve is expediency. We want to be able to respond quickly in order to land that next big fish. But as any of you who were here for the 1997 session or the 1999 sessions might recall, supersiding is not exactly super fast. Back then the subject was supersiding a prison, but it is a close parallel to what House Bill 3314 could be. In other words, without community cooperation, projects are likely to drag on for years without getting off the ground. So I'm guessing that this supersiding bill, like the prison one, is really about siding something over local objections. And I would point out that developing any big project and providing the necessary infrastructure for them is not an easy thing to do, even when everyone is for it and everyone is working hard to get it done. And the reverse of that, if the local community or the local government or local service provider is opposed to the project, you will most certainly face a long uphill battle no matter what sort of supersiding authority you give the governor or anyone else. And what business, with so many towns eager to have them, is likely to want to locate in a community that's hostile to them? It's sort of like forcing someone to marry you against their will, and you have to be realistic that the long-term prospects for a happy future are not very good. regards to the prison superciding debacle, once the Department of Corrections agreed to site their facility where the city wanted it rather than on the supersided site that the DOC wanted, and once they started, we started working together with them to address the local infrastructure deficiencies, the community embraced the project and we've had no problems since then. But House Bill 3314, as has been pointed out, sets up one individual, in this case the governor, who alone gets to decide that an economic emergency exists, and he or she alone gets to decide which business will alleviate that emergency and where that business should be located. He or she can then choose to ignore statutes, goals, and local comprehensive plans over the objections of the host community. The idea that this top-down sort of power structure is somehow a faster, cheaper, more efficient, or more attractive way to do business is a fallacy, as the state of Oregon and just about every other state that has ever tried it has discovered. Supersiding is none of those things. It is not efficient or necessary even to site unpopular uses like prisons, and it's certainly not needed to site industries that so many communities, including Wilsonville, would be happy to accommodate. Thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions about supersiding if it's praying on your mind.
You'll be becoming our in-house specialist in May. Any questions of the good mayor? Representative Greenlee.
We have another supersiding bill here that is an attempt to take away the supersiding authority and give the cities some involvement in that. I assume, I don't know whether you're planning on testifying to that, but
another supersiding bill today. You're looking at another one.
I think so.
I didn't see one.
Security and the mayor did speak in that.
Okay.
Yes. That's what this one.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
Mr. McPhillip.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for talking to me. My name is Alex McPhail, and I represent a group called the Coalition to Save the Valley. These comments are, if the governor, in fact, is going to get this bill killed, that's fine. But my comments may be germane to other bills coming down the road. I feel we have a land use system that overall really works. Measure 37 is probably going to bring some changes in parts of it, but in general at the moment it's working. It provides for local control, which I, as an immigrant many years ago, think that goes dead against what I thought was the Oregon way, which is let the people do what they want to do. This local support provides for planning and building of roads, utilities, transportation, and all the other facilities that you need for industry. It can be done, and Wilsonville has proven that. I will skip over my comments on 3314, except to say that I don't think there is an emergency here, except perhaps in the minds of the land speculators and other developers. I'd like to make one comment on the process for a newcomer or an amateur like myself. The legislative process seems to be designed to foster confusion. We have placeholder bills, we have instantaneous amendments, we have gotten stuff, we have something called a tap-tap hearing. I'm learning quickly, but it's difficult. The average citizen becomes very frustrated and eventually gets just plain worn down. And then, lo and behold, here comes the bill when there's nobody left to object to it. I and the rest of the people up at CSC do appreciate all the hard work you're doing, really, and thank you.
Any questions of Mr. McPhail?
I'd just like to comment that as a member of the minority, I've become particularly sensitive to the kind of things you're talking about.
Thank you.
Art Slack and Linda Ludwig.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the representative a question?
Yes, Representative Slack.
I'm just wondering if the majority vote would be different.
From a different perspective.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Obviously, the League is opposed to this bill and very much appreciates the comments that Mayor Lehan had to give the committee today regarding her superciding and the City of Wilsonville's experience with that. Absolute superciding efforts by the state are problematic for local governments for many, many reasons, one of which are the long-term infrastructure capacity issues and how local jurisdictions deal with that in their long-term planning efforts after the governor may weigh his, under this bill, magic wand and supersite a new development. Again, I don't want to take up a lot of your time giving you examples of how that may be the case. I think it's easy to see and invite any questions and just say we would oppose this type of very, very stringent superciding bill.
Any questions of Ms. Ludwig? Art?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. And I guess let me climb onto the wagon with the other people that you've heard and express our concern with regard to House Bill 3314. As you well know, the Association of Oregon Counties is a advocate for local control, local responsibility as it relates to land use and land use planning. And as such, we do not support supersiding and would not support the provisions of this bill. We certainly appreciate the letter from the governor's office at this point and his acknowledgement that while he is the governor of the state of Oregon, he doesn't necessarily want to be king for a day or for his term at this point.
I cover the election too.
That'll work. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the time that you've given us and I'd answer any questions if there are any.
Any questions for Mr. Slack? Seeing none, thank you both very much. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I read this bill maybe a little bit differently. I certainly am in favor of local people having great input, and certainly I feel that way in terms of the annexation bills we're hearing. But I see this as an economic emergency, or even an emergency, where two localities may pretty much tie in the benefits to site a really attractive business. And I think there come times where to have a judicious governor who can look at the facts and unemotionally and unpolitically make a decision would be a benefit to our state. It's a little bit different situation, but I remember a number of years ago when we were very active with economic development in the Medford area, that we had a Harper's Piano, a major firm, wanted to come to the Northwest, and they were faced with a situation they couldn't really decide between Medford or the Spokane area up in Washington. And it came down in a final determination that the governors of Washington and Idaho showed up in Spokane, well, actually in Post Falls, Idaho, and said, Harpers, we want you here. We want you to come. And even though all of the factors seem equally divided, we feel that you should come here to our site. Governor Roberts at that time neglected to send a letter, never showed up, and guess where that firm went? The power of the governor was strong enough to take them to Post Falls. I think there are benefits to be had in a project like this, where not to be used very often, if ever, but to have that ability for a strong governor who is doing the best he can to distinguish between the two could do that final sighting. I think that certainly falls within the purvey of this bill, and I think there is some wisdom to it.
Any other committee member wish to speak on the bill? Thank you, Lord. Make me look like less of a fool now. We shall close the public hearing on House Bill 3314 and open a work session, a public hearing on House Bill 3081. And Representative Smith, would you want to open out there, or would you like me?
Yeah, here, and I'd like Newberry to join.
We'd like to have Tom and Leslie Newberry come forward, along with Representative Smith, to present the bill. Sam?
And while they're finding the seats, House Bill 3081 is one which will authorize cities or counties to be able to approve an application to divide a lot of parcel that was unlawfully divided. If the governing body approves, had approved a development permit on any portion of either of the parcel of the, or through a partition or subdivision, and in doing so, then that recognizes that the government had taken some action in recognition of the, regardless of the lawfulness of that particular piece of property. So this bill would then be able to allow the city or county to be able to approve that in that case.
Thank you, Sam. Good afternoon, Representative.
Thank you, Chair Gillard. Welcome to the committee, I guess. It's funny being on this side rather than that side. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent East Multnomah, East Clackamas, and all of Hood River County. I brought this bill, and I have to my left is Tom and Leslie Newberry. And if you remember, we heard their testimony in the Sandy hearing. Representative Gillard and Representative Greenick both did. We're at that attendance in that hearing in Sandy. And we have tried unsuccessfully to solve their problem. And I brought this bill to hopefully address an issue that is ongoing in this state. As a representative, I get many land use calls. And as you can tell, probably every one of them is different. But one of the most confusing and frustrating is to somebody who bought their property not knowing that it was an illegal partition, and the county can't solve the problem. It is a state issue. So that's why I brought this bill. And I thought I would just turn it over to them, let them tell you their story, and if you have any questions. And there are amendments coming to this bill, and you're going to hear more about them from other people that wish to testify. And Senator Metzger has also said he wants to work on solving this problem. He was also at that hearing in Sandy. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Tom and Russell Newberry.
Good afternoon and welcome.
Thanks, sir. My name is Tom Newberry. This is my wife, Leslie. Real brief for those of you who weren't in Sandy and didn't hear us before. A couple of years ago, my lovely bride surprised me with the news that we were going to have a new child that we didn't expect. As we were living in a 100-year-old farmhouse that was just about right size-wise for us before this news, we sought to make a few changes. One of the things we needed to address, though, was some retrofitting a new foundation, some other things for the house. My wife went down and contacted the county and was told, basically, that they couldn't find anything indicating we had a lot of record, which, of course, we knew nothing about what that meant. The long story short was, in 1978... I think a nursery company bought the approximately 20-acre farm.
Mid-70s
bought it, and later in that decade, split off approximately 2 acres that our house sits on and sold it, which I guess was a fairly common practice. Unfortunately, it ran afoul of a change in land use laws. When we bought the property in the 90s. This wasn't an issue anybody was aware of. Title companies didn't check for it. Realtors didn't know what it meant. And the bottom line was that we were told we had a property. We couldn't do anything. We couldn't sell, couldn't improve. And now we're stuck. We were offered a few possible solutions by the county that were pretty much predicated on the goodwill of others or maybe me winning the lottery, another, which is happening. We cannot afford to buy back the 17 acres that was originally part of the property, and neither is the person who owns it willing to sell it back. We're stuck. My wife is the one that's organized and's got all the paperwork here for you that she submitted, and I'm going to give it to her now.
I'm not good at just winning yet like my husband is, so I've kind of prepared the written testimony here. Part of it recaps what my husband said. In approximately August of 2003, since that time we've been trying to resolve this issue with property being unlawfully created. Multnomah County's tax assessor's office allowed the tax lot to be created and the deed conveyed to new owners three times since its creation in 1978. Multnomah County issued a Woodstove permit to us, in the early 80s, to the first owner of the property after it had been divided, and then one to us a month after we had purchased the property in 1993. 10 years later, they said that they cannot issue us permits to add on or to replace the house or to do the foundation work because the property was not a lot of record. Because of my unexpected pregnancy and everything else, there's kind of a gap in the timeline here. I sort of got more involved again this last fall. I was not a realtor at the time that we purchased our property, so knew very little about the process. I have been a realtor now for the last 7 years, and I am now the resident expert in my office on unlawfully created properties. And giving little seminars and everything else to my office. In January of this year, my husband and I, along with other property owners that have unlawful parcels that we were fortunate to connect with, spoke before the Multnomah County Planning Commission. The lot of record issue was on that work session agenda for that evening, and so it turns out that our testimonies were timely. The discussion went several directions, but it did not seem to truly resolve any of the issues at hand. I got an introduction letter that I read to the planners in that meeting included, as well as the planning minutes from that meeting. But shortly after the planning meeting, and after several email exchanges with Derek Tokos, who's here today, he's one of the senior planners with Multnomah County, I continued to try to resolve the problem in other ways because the issues that we had discussed at the planning meeting did not seem to be something that would necessarily help us. Fortunately, Multnomah County had put on their public website all of the old maps and all of the old ordinances as a response to the Measure 37 having passed. Measure 37 doesn't apply to our situation in any way that I can see, but I did, in fact, use that ability to go back and research the ordinances in January of this year, and I found something that was referred to as a lot of exception that I was not at all familiar with, and it had never come up in any discussion with us at the planning department. And so at that point, I inquired with Multnomah County about could our property have been a lot of exception. If it couldn't be then, could it be now? And I asked him several questions regarding this. And a week or two later, he gave me a call and said that they had found some documentation in the files and that back in 1978, the county had, in fact, after the fact, discovered the property had been unlawfully divided. They found this out when, I guess, the contract for sale to the initial people was recorded. The property was illegally divided, but they also recommended at that point that there was a way to solve the problem if the landowner that was still in ownership of the remaining 17 acres, who owned a 10-acre parcel adjoining it, would combine those two properties, then we would be legal. And so I scrambled and scrambled to try to find if a deed had been created to that effect. I have a copy of the letter of violation. I have a copy of the approval for the lot of exception. The deed that he was supposed to put together for the 10 and the 17 acres was never recorded. I've contacted him personally. His testimony on a telephone conversation was his understanding that he didn't have to do that at his time. He was not concerned about developing that 10 and 17 acres or making it a legal lot because he just wanted to turn the dirt. He was a farmer. So it was his understanding that he could flag those properties at some county level and that if they were ever to be developed, then they would have to be joined. That was his story. In any case, the county, once we found out that the deed had not been recorded, because those two other parcels adjoining ours were now owned three owners later by the same party, the plan was that we could contact the current owner to see if he would join those two parcels, making us legal. He's been out of the state now for all of winter, but I managed to get a hold of him just last week, and he is absolutely not willing to help us. He sees no purpose in it to benefit him. And so between the county saying, this is your only solution, and our landowner neighbor saying, what's in it for me, or I don't need to do this for you, we're still stuck. We did appeal our property taxes last year and as well as this last year. We did it in for 2003 and 2004. We managed to get a small reduction in your property tax appeal. They're going to be sending us back a $580 check out of our $2,100 property taxes. So the property being unlawfully created puts us in a position where we can't legally even sell the property. So legally, by the market values, it has no value. So we're still paying property taxes and we still can't sell the property. There are other property owners in similar straits, one just a half a mile from our property, where they had a deal that a real estate transaction that fell apart, tried to rectify it, $18,000 in attorney fees later. They have still not solved the problem. Terry Gonzalez is here today. She has had a similar problem up in northwest Multnomah County. Had some major remodeling done to a house in 1993, went to get a garage permit last year. County said, oh, but it looks like it's not lawfully created. Connie Kreitz as well. My concern with the verbiage in House Bill 3081, as Patty submitted it to me a couple of weeks ago, is the term unlawful division, I think. In some of the correspondence in my packet between Derek and I, it's my understanding that the division of our property went through the normal channels to be divided. So in the strictest sense of the term, our property wasn't illegally divided. However, it was illegally created because it did not meet all applicable land use laws, and that meant the zoning laws as well. The zoning laws had changed to 20-acre minimums 4 months before that contract for sale had been recorded initially. And the other side of that coin, too, is my understanding is that there was no mechanism in place at the county level to actually check and to send people to the planning department before they were doing those illegal divisions. So while the landowner did get caught at that later point 4 months later, there was nothing in place at the time he did the illegal division to send him to planning to say, you can or you cannot do this. So while, you know, there was some misdeed or mischance, you know, those nursery guys, they need to turn the dirt. They don't need a house to be as a rental. So even today as a realtor, I would love to see some legislation, and this is a little bit aside from this, that would allow the homes to be broken off from the bigger chunks so that they could be sold. I work with people all the time who want a little acre land out in the country. But in any case, my biggest concern was with House Bill 3081 is the term regarding the development permit. The folks in 1980 got a wood stove permit. We got a wood stove permit in 1993. Well, then the county will not recognize a wood stove or a mechanical permit as a development permit. If something is amended to this documentation on this bill, I would ask that it use the terminology of unlawfully created parcels, that it refer to either, you know, development permits, including mechanical residential permits, or some verbiage in there regarding a home that pre-existed the permitting stage. Our house is 100 years old. It didn't require a permit when it was built. And so I just want to be able to fix it and live on it and maybe rebuild it if the case be, but then sell it eventually. So that's my testimony.
Thank you both. And you can see the passion.
and we've come a long way in 100 years, haven't we?
Yes, we have, except we still can't fix up the property.
Representative, I want to make sure that we're on the right track here as far as in regard to what Mrs. Newberry would like amended in the bill. I want to make sure she's making reference to line 11.
She has, yeah. And what... There are other amendments coming to this bill. We have -1 amendments, but the verbiage isn't accurate in that either. So we're going to have further testimony on what the amendments will do, and it will not only fix their problem, we need to look at this as a state issue. The way I have been told, Multnomah County, it's not a county issue, it's a state issue. So we need to look at the whole language as far as to make sure we have it accurate. So I brought this bill to start that discussion. I think we need to have that discussion, and we need to fix their problem. And
I did, on people, like two or three pages back, I had kind of worded out some revision notes on that same bill.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Greenwood.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Newberry, you have under other properties this Kreitz property, and you have a news story that apparently is fairly old. Do you know whether the Kreitz issue has been resolved?
The Kreitz issue, to my knowledge, has not been resolved. Just last month, I believe, one of the neighboring properties, they were granted after initial denial of a lot of record. They were, in fact, granted based on some issuance of building permits. And I didn't include that because I was starting to get too thick, I thought. So,
if I may,
the Kreitz
property. I met with the Kreitzes, their six neighbors, and the Multnomah County folks more than a year ago, and it was my understanding that Multnomah County had the way to resolve that problem for them, and I hope it has been resolved. But in that discussion, the county did, in fact, I'm not sure how far I want to go on the record, the county staff was working hard to bend whatever they could to make it fit that those six properties in my district. But they also expressed concern that sometimes they wanted to do something that made sense, and there were statutory limitations to that, and I encourage them to help us find ways to make sure they could get this lot of record things straightened out. But I certainly hope the crisis, and I'll take this opportunity to check into it. I certainly hope their problem's been.
Connie actually spoke at the January Planning Commission meeting. January. So it's been two and a half months since I've spoken to her last week at that point. She was still feeling very much taken as a hostage by the county.
I'll check in.
Any further questions? Representative Ackerman.
Just a question from general knowledge. Assuming that you get the development permit or building permit, I don't know what a development permit is. maybe that should be redefined, but that's not my question. My question is there any prohibition on selling an unlawfully divided lot? In other words, you get your development permit, you do what you want to do, and you find you try to go to sell it, the county comes back and says, well, a lot was unlawfully created, and we gave you as much as we can do, now we can't. You can't legally convey it.
I don't think that the county has the legal authority to do that, and that's why the property has been able to be exchanged hands three times. My understanding of what was told to me is they can't restrict it to legally convey. However, ORS 92.018 has buyer's remedies that the buyer can sue a seller who sells them an unlawfully created parcel. So the county is not going to say, no, you can't do that. I have to learn.
One follow-up, but don't you think you would need that protection? Why should you go through, get your development permit, convey the property to a third party that doesn't know that it was illegally formed, and they come back and sue you? Shouldn't we fix that up front?
Shouldn't
we fix it up front so you can convey?
Absolutely.
That is, in fact, what we're attempting to do here.
What we want to be a lot of record. We don't just want to be able to obtain our permits. In fact, when we first went to the county in August of 2003, one of the things that they handed me was Multnomah County Code 37.056. And that basically said unless it met all land use applications that were zoning and division, we could not obtain permits. Now, at about 7 months pregnant, I went in there saying, I live in a 100-year-old farmhouse. I have old, electrical stuff. If my baby dies in my house, I'm coming after you is kind of what I did. And
the house burns down.
If my house burns down and my baby dies, I'm not going to be very happy. And in May of 2004, 6 or 7 months later, we had a couple things happen besides just me throwing a hormonal storm. According to something that Mr. Topos had told me in a conversation when I was trying to do some research for a seminar for my office, he told me that they had made some revisions to 37.056. They had a situation out on Sobeys Island, and I'm sure Derek will correct me if I'm wrong when he testifies, but Northwest Natural Gas owned an easement across what was an unlawfully created parcel. They went to the county to get a permit to work on the gas line, and Multnomah County said, 37.056 restricts us from giving permits on unlawfully created parcels. Oh, this is a natural gas pipeline. Oh, this could be a hazard and a safety issue to the public. And so they revised that.
Yeah.
So they revised the code and added a public safety clause in there. Likewise, after my hormonal storm, they also added a paragraph in there that said that for abatement purposes of deteriorating systems such as roof, furnace, those sorts of things, a property could also obtain permits for that. What we can't still obtain is full structural permits, to my understanding, no additions to the property, and it still doesn't resolve the issue of the property's lawful creation being a law of record. So, yeah, we can go out now and get a few permits, but the property's defect is still not corrected. And so I don't want to throw money into a defective property.
The problem is, from my humble opinion anyway, is that 30 years ago when the state, as a people, we made a bold leap forward with the land use plan system that we've got now. By and large, it's been successful. The problem you get, in my opinion, when you paint with a really broad brush, is you miss a lot of spots. A lot of cracks and things to fall through, and not only ourselves, but George Plummer, who's a planner, I believe, from Multnomah County, told me he fears there may be hundreds of these properties in Multnomah County alone, and they really only surface when someone comes forward and wants to do something the right way, as in our case. I think Measure 37 was probably a good indicator of people's frustrations when they ran up against the land use system in this state, and it experienced it as a stone wall. I think what we need, this is an embodiment of the need to have some practices in place that would allow fixing of these problems so you don't get this large body of people out there who feel like they're butting their heads against a wall. I'm a very pro-planning person. I'm pro-intelligent land use. I'm not trying, my wife and I are not trying to divide a property illegal. This property was done years and years before we came along. We're just kind of inherited it after the fact, and we'd like to fix it and make it right. And so would, I'm sure, all these other people who are in the same boat.
Any further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony, Representative. We're going to bring the counties up, Derek Takas and Art Schlack. I'm moving you up in the schedule, Art, because some of our committee members would like to know just how prevalent this problem is. So, and Stephanie.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's Stephanie Soden here with Multnomah County, and I've brought with me today the infamous Derek Takas, who's been referred to explain the county's position on the bill as currently written, and then some ideas about ways to fix it so the Newberry's situation could be addressed, as well as other property owners in the state.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Garrard. Thank you, members of the House Land Use Committee. Again, my name is Derek Takas. I'm Principal Planner with Multnomah County Land Use Planning. First off, we did submit some testimony here. I'm not going to read through it, but it does cover a lot of the issues discussed today. I did want to thank Representative Smith for bringing this bill to you and for bringing this conversation out and open so the discussion can happen about that. Too often, buyers, innocent buyers, do not know what they're buying. They're not advised of what they're buying when they purchase it by their realtor. Their title company doesn't let them know if there's a problem with the title of property in terms of an illegal land division. They may or may not know that they need to talk to a county planning agency to know what the land use rules are, and they buy an illegal lot, and that's a problem. Now, while we don't support this bill as drafted, we do recognize that there's value in exploring legislation of this nature, and we did include in our testimony some suggestions as to how the legislation could be improved. Let me first say, the county didn't create the Newberry's problem here. A prior owner did when they divided this 19-acre property illegally. And now that property has been sold several times. The home that was on the 2-acre one property was an older farm home. There was no land use activity on either of those properties for a long time. The county's not involved in the conveyance process, so it sat that way for a very long time. You know, I'll not go through the nuts and bolts of all the circumstances in Newberry, but it is correct. You know, they came to us, and that's when we saw the problem and pointed it out to them. And it's many, many, many years after the problem. And our options are limited. Now, there is a non-legislative solution here, and that is that the other landowner who owns that 17, who also has an illegal property, can fix this situation if he combines it with the 10 acres he owns to the south. Now, the Newberrys have testified that they've contacted him. We've pointed out the problem, too, to the new owner once we knew of the situation, and I've talked to them as well. You know, he's on vacation in California. He recognizes that there's a problem, but it's not as pressing to him because he doesn't have immediate interest in developing the 17 acres. He's not averse to fixing it sometime in the future, but, you know, it's not an immediate issue for him right now. It's not an immediate interest of his right now to combine those properties. Now, in terms of the concerns we have with the bill as drafted, I think the biggest concern we have would be the linkage to development permits in general. The county did issue a mechanical permit for the home, but no jurisdiction, to my knowledge, would look at legal lot issues on an incidental mechanical permit. And if we were looking into the legality of every lot in detail every time our building bureau issues an incidental permit for a mechanical, for a wood stove or an electrical or something like that, that would really bog down the development process. So I think that target to the solution is an issue that should be revisited. And we have some suggestions in our testimony which really kind of fall in line like this. The fix needs to focus on helping people who bought the problem, not people who created the problem. Also, there needs to be a disincentive in any fix that would make it a convenient way to circumvent the laws. And so then there are a number of ways to do that, and we include some suggestions on that. But I think the biggest point that we wanted to bring to here is that any solution here needs to be prospective, not just retroactive. The county is not involved at the time of the conveyance. When somebody's buying property, they're advised by a realtor. They may have a title company who's involved, but the county's not a part of that. So this solution on the prospective side of things is not a government solution per se. Now, I included an example in here. There are a number of ways you can go about trying to tackle the prospective aspect of this. But ideally, we don't want illegal lots created, and we certainly don't want people buying illegal lots. And so, for example, if title companies were actually ensuring that a lot was legally created at the time of the conveyance, we may see a lot more of these issues flushed out before people buy the problem and have to deal with it after the fact. So that was kind of the gist of this issue. This is a very real issue for the Newberrys. We've tried to help them. We've been as proactive as we can. We do have limits under our own rules, but we also wanted to kind of point out this issue in a holistic way so you could see how the different pieces fit together. And you know, with that, I'll close, but would again thank Representative Smith for bringing this bill to your attention. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Douglas, Representative Greenman?
Derek, thank you. Do you know where the crisis situation has been resolved up in Morgan Road?
I can speak to that and appreciate the question. And the circumstances there was a situation where it was an illegal subdivision. Several lots and a road were illegally subdivided and created. The person who did that knew that it was a problem at the time. It's not the people who own it now. And the county did have some culpability about, in their 80s, we issued building permits for it. Now, the difference here is when we issued building permits in the 80s, the county made a determination on the face of those permits the land division was okay. And so the fix that we outlined for them was one where they could go through and make an application to the county for determination as to whether or not they have a lot of record. And the decision we made there was, you know, the county decided the issue in the 80s. We're stopped from revisiting that issue now. We can't make that same decision differently today than we did in the 80s. The county wouldn't look at land division issues with a mechanical permit.
If I may.
Okay.
Explain that. They said it was legal in, so therefore it's legal now.
We said the county made a determination effectively that it was legal in the 80s. We're stopped, so to speak. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't get into the nuts and bolts of estoppel, but we can't revisit that decision now.
So they are legal is what you're saying.
Well, we advised that they needed to file an application and go through a land use process. If somebody wanted to appeal it, they'd have a right to do so. To my knowledge, only one person has gone through that. It wasn't the Kreitzes yet. They haven't availed themselves of that application process, at least to my knowledge.
May I follow on that?
I'm not sure what he said.
It's either legal or it isn't. And I think Representative Greenleaf asked you directly, if in the 80s you ruled it was legal, your response was, it's legal now. But somebody had to go through the... Yeah. You've got us all confused at this point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
He's already told us he's not an attorney. I think that means he's not qualified to give a legal opinion. And pushing him to do so probably is beyond what he ought to be asked to do.
Well, he's not authorized to give a legal opinion, but he has told them they should do something. He has told them they should file for a land use action. So he's giving an opinion, whether it's a legal opinion. It may be no more legal than the opinion was in 1986. But the question is, I'm just trying to find out what he told my constituents.
I can take another step.
He was incidentally very helpful. I didn't even say this, and I said it before. I met with them. They were, I thought, extraordinarily helpful in meeting with the Kreitzes and their neighbors, and I started this conversation with that. I just want to see where it's going.
Okay, I'll take another brief stab at it. Essentially, what we said was, look, if you file an application for determination as to whether or not your lot is legal, we'll evaluate the circumstances. It appears, and in fact was the fact, that in the 80s the county signed off on building permits, and on the face of those documents signed off on the land division. Now, there's no evidence that they ever really looked at the issues and recognized that, hey, wait, there really was a problem here. It was done in a very ministerial way. But nonetheless, there were initials from the county that the land division was okay when the people came in to get a building permit for the house. And so when they filed this application, and not, like I said, Ms. Kreitz didn't do it, but one of the other owners has already, for a determination as to whether or not their lot was legal, essentially what we're saying in a land use forum where it's all open and appealable is the county made that determination in the 80s and is standing by that determination.
Thank you. I understand.
Okay.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes, to the representatives of Multnomah County, I just want to make sure that this act, House Bill 3081, does give these folks remedy. If I understand the facts, they got a mechanical permit from the city of Gresham for a wood stove. All right? But the act says the development permit must be issued by the governing body, which I assume is Multnomah County. So do they have a remedy? Because a development permit would have to, under the act, be issued by Multnomah County, not the city of Gresham.
Okay.
Am I reading that right?
Representative Ackerman, understanding that we're not comfortable with the language as drafted, but I can respond to your question in terms of the distinction between Gresham and Multnomah County. Gresham acts as an agent for Multnomah County under contract.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Smith.
I just want to raise the point, and I wanted to raise it while I was down there, and I didn't, but development permit, and I might ask Derek this question, development permit, we were told under the East Cindy Rule plan when we did that in 1995, was any permit that was issued. Any permit.
Mm-hmm.
So why would not a mechanical permit be a development permit?
I'm going to respond to that question in terms of how we interact with the public, maybe not so much on just what a development permit is in somebody's general understanding, because I think there is a lot of ways to view it, and a lot of people think of it in different terms. But I just want to explain to you in terms of the relationship with how we interact with the public. We interact with the public on land use matters, and there are a lot of land use permits or land use decisions that folks have to do to develop their property. There's also something, you know, there's a building permit, and a building permit does not really, in our jurisdiction, since we contract on building services, there's not a lot of interaction between us and our public at the building permit level, because they're interacting with either the city of Gresham or the city of Portland. Building permits are much more ministerial. They are, you know, there's not a lot of discretion involved. You're talking about the building codes themselves. And so we wouldn't necessarily see, we don't actually on a day-to-day basis see mechanical permits for a wood stove in our land use planning office. Gresham sees them, but we don't, because there's really not a land use issue there, per se. Does that help?
No. I was told in 1995 by Multnomah County that a development permit was any permit issued on any property in Multnomah County. So that's why I think we need to explore that issue of what actually is a development permit, that terminology. And it's not something you can answer, but I was told that, personally told that. We've denied many permits in Multnomah County. And that's where I live, is why I know that county so well. But we were denied permits for development of any kind, So that meant any kind of permit. So a permit was considered a development permit, so. I'm hoping Mr. Schlack will tell us that.
Ms. Schlack, and I'll let you go. I just have to ask you one more question. Who's at fault when an illegal lot, an illegal parcel, or an illegal subdivision, God forbid, who's at fault when that's done?
Generally, it's the landowner who does it, creates the illegal land division. So, you know, if somebody goes and decides, I want to carve up my piece of property, And they just go and divide it in half and don't check in to see if that was something that was legal to do, that would be their responsibility.
Well, what I ask is your function.
In terms of the developability of a property, if a piece of, you know, when people want to develop property in Multnomah County and most of the jurisdictions in the state, you have to meet land use rules that are in effect at that time. Often those rules require that the property that you want to develop on is illegal. We check that when we evaluate development at that time.
Somehow we got back to that same issue again. I'm just trying to figure out when something illegal is done, who's at fault for that? And you're telling me it's the property owner.
This guy in six lots in Mike was never bothered to file it. He just divided it and started selling.
So it's done without? Yeah. It can be done without your approval.
Correct. Illegal land divisions are done without even our knowledge in many cases.
Okay.
He just divided up and started selling the land.
Okay.
Somewhere
that's part of the bigger discussion we have to have. But on this particular case, that was a condition of the approval given by Multnomah County. Am I correct?
In this case, the illegal division happened without our knowledge. The division happened. However, our staff picked it up after the fact, contacted the person who did it, and advised him of a remedy, which involved a review by the county. He went through that review, got an approval. The condition was he combined the 17 acres with the property owned to the south, the 10. He had the legal description to do it. All he had to do is plug it into a deed and record it. He never did that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your patience with the committee. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Sumner.
Just out of curiosity, how does a lot of record, legal or illegal, manage to get on the Multnomah County tax rolls without anybody catching the legality of the division? And for how many years do you collect the taxes before you determine that that's an illegal division?
I'm a land use planner, so I can only go so far with that. But I suspect that if you contacted assessment offices, they would tell you they assess property as it's used, not whether or not it was necessarily created legally.
Thank you.
You got somewhat the same kind of answer.
Right, so thank you very much. Mr. Stott.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Art Slot with the Association of Oregon Counties. Let me first see if I can clear up or maybe add to the puzzlement at this point dealing with lawfully created parcels. The state of Oregon has partition and subdivision regulations. A partition is if I want to create three parcels or two or three parcels, then I go through a partitioning exercise. If I want to create four or more, by definition, I'm a subdivision. And there's a process to go through that. That's a land use process, and I think everybody knows about that. Unfortunately, as the case may be, I can go create tax lots and take those to the county and have and create divisions of property without, you know, for the purposes of assessment. And I can create a whole lot of those, potentially a 100-acre piece, and I can say, well, I'm going to rent 20 acres to you, Chair Gerard, and I tell the assessor that I want to create a separate tax lot so that I know the taxes on that 20 acres. I can just pass that to Representative Gerard, and he'll do that. He'll do that with regardless of whether that is a separate lawfully created parcel through partition or subdivision at this point. And that's one of the major problems that we have in the land use planning, determining what's a lawfully created parcel, because many parcels that are created in rural Oregon are created not through a deed and sales contract prior to subdivision and partition, or since that through those other processes. So you got to do one or the other. And so that's part of the dilemma, and many times these tax lots are created, they're sold because there's nothing that precludes them if somebody hasn't gone through the process of determining that's a lawfully created parcel. And some counties have a process to determine. You can come in and ask for a determination if it's a lawfully created parcel. But not everybody, you know, that's looking at purchasing a piece of property does that. But those are the safeguards. But that, there is that disconnect between the subdivision process and the assessor for assessment purposes, creating units of land and having a tax lot number on them, and it's discrete with a meets and bounds description or something like that, but that doesn't necessarily create a lawfully created parcel. And that's why when we're here, we talk about lawfully created parcels, because there's lots of tax lots out there. And that's what happened, I guess, in Representative Greenlick's area, where somebody just created the parcels and began to sell those, and nobody, you know, did those other checks, and he didn't go through the subdivision process.
It's just shocking that with all of our land use laws, people can still go out and do whatever they want to.
Mr. Chair, in some respects they can.
Yeah.
And that's what gets us many times before your committee to try and figure out how we can make things legal or address certain issues. And Mr. Chair, with that, probably further confused everybody on the committee. I hope not, but let me say with regard to the bill that's before you, I had the opportunity and the pleasure to speak to Representative Smith earlier today. I've had several conversations with the Department of Land Conservation and Development and with legal counsel for Multnomah County with regard to what we've identified as a positive fix and potential amendment to House Bill 3081. What the amendment would do would create the opportunity or create a one-lot partition and that would provide the opportunity to create a legal lot out of a parcel that had been created or been approved by a local government through a preliminary partition or subdivision, but not effectuated, not recorded. And it would allow the owner of that parcel, based on certain criteria, to submit a one-lot partition and make that lot legal.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Yes,
if you have an illegal property, it's then approved by a government agency, city or county, does that now make that parcel legal?
Would you explain that by me one more time?
If you have an illegal
right
property, but somehow through the system, that property is identified and approved by the governing body, does that then make that piece of property legal?
Mr. Chair, if the county had issued a building permit for a house, there is circumstances where the county would then recognize that lot as a lawfully created parcel. You get into a lot of details, and it's different from one jurisdiction to another at this point. And attorneys can disagree with regard to that. What we're suggesting with the amendment that we would draft is to very clearly provide the process by which a lot, in this case, a lot that Multnomah County authorized with its preliminary approval, but it didn't get recorded. It didn't get implemented. And through the current owner, in and of itself, does not have the ability to do that. It cannot go and record the partition that Multnomah County approved several years ago. But we do have the authority, with an adjustment in statute, to authorize that lot to be lawfully created as a one-lot partition.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Yes. So, Mr. Sack, is this particular to the crisis, or does David Smith and the Obrists, are those lots similar? Could they be covered by the same lot of, more than a line of record, but not a parcel? What was the term you used?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the term I was using was a one-lot partition. It's based on the fact situation that we develop, and there are a lot of unlawfully, so I'm not sure that we can do something that will encompass all of those. But there will be more, I will assure you, there will be more than the subject property of this bill that will be able to use this legislation. But I cannot tell you that every situation that, would be able to do it at this point.
Any further questions on this panel? Representative Ackerman.
No, I'm still concerned about the point I raised earlier about, thank you, about the subsequent conveyances of illegal lots. And I don't want to put more on this bill than we should, but it seems to me that we could provide some process by which a disclaimer is on the deed as it is now regarding land use, or that the parties as a part of the closing process would have to sign or acknowledge that, particularly the sellers, that the lot was lawfully created, so we get this issue solved up front as a part of the closing process of real estate transactions. And I see Harvard Levy out there. I don't want to give him any more work than he already has, but that might be something that would save liability for lots of folks, including realtors and real estate professionals that deal in this, that just might omit this step.
Mr. Chair, represent
for a response, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, with the approval of a partition, a one-lot partition, and the recording of that in the county, that lot is a lawfully created parcel, and it will not carry any cloud with it any further at that point.
Okay, thank you. We would like to thank both of you for coming today, representing Multnomah County. Your patience with the committee was appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Speaking of Harlan Levy, Harlan and Dave Honeycutt and Teresa Gonzalez, please.
I can't have Bruce's possession.
Teresa, I'm really putting the rose between two thorns.
That's putting it bluntly, Mr. Chair.
Why don't we let Teresa go first?
I'm just going to, my name is Teresa Gonzalez.
That way I can get you out of there fast.
Beg your pardon?
I can get you out of there faster.
Okay. My husband, David Smith, and I purchased this property in 1992. I'm just going to give you a timeline. I don't have all the details as Leslie and her husband do, but I just want to let you know that there are a lot of people out there that are in this situation, and we don't know what to do. We purchased our property in 1992, 7.60 acres. We had a real estate agent, we had title insurance, we did the whole thing. We were assuming everything was on the legal. We were issued a permit in 1994 because we did a total remodel of the house. We gutted what was there and did a total remodel. It took 9 months. There were people from the county often on our property on a daily basis, in and out. They not only issued us permits, but they signed off on all the permits as everything was done correctly. In 2002, we decided that we wanted to build a garage, so we applied for a permit for a garage, and that's when we found out, and we were told that our lot was not legally divided. It was not a lot of record, and we did not know what that meant. We didn't know. We just didn't know. We were just hit with we were living on a piece of illegal property. We tried to get a lot of record determined, and we were denied. Just flat out told that this was an illegal lot and there was nothing we could do about it. Last week we had the appeal hearing, and right now we're waiting to hear what that decision is. We cannot convey our property in any way. We can't build, we can't sell. We have appealed our taxes because we're told that the market value of our home is zero. And that was also denied. We have been paying taxes. We are on the tax roll. There is a map, an outline of our property. And they don't seem to know why we can have... I mean, I learned a little bit from what the county said a couple moments ago. But when you go in as, just somebody trying to get their permits and are told that you're on an illegal lot... there is no answer as to why we've been paying property taxes for almost 13 years, and no one has ever said, I mean, they always took our money, so no one has ever mentioned that this is an illegal lot. Permits were issued in 1974 to build the original dwelling, so there were permits issued at that time. And the county's solution to us is to combine our property with the seller's property. Our home has been there since 74. Since 74. We've been there since 92. We bought 7.5 acres. We don't want 20 acres. And that's just my story, and I just wanted to let you know what was going on. We are just up in the air and getting absolutely no answers other than we're illegal and we're on a piece of property that it really has zero market value, and we can't do anything. We can't sell. We can't build.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Gonzalez, can you tell me who issued you that permit that you got for the remodel? Was it Multnomah County or
yes, was it City of Red Hook? Yes, it was Multnomah County.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
How did the title company handle this?
We were told by the title company that they had nothing to do with this. They only cover any liens or any money that is owed. There's no, they don't cover any land, you know, any land use. It's just a matter of liens and that kind of thing. And I cannot speak to seller because I don't know what he did or did not do. He's still in the picture, and we're, you know, still trying to work with him, but he was under the impression that this was a legal lot. That's where we
follow.
Maybe the two attorneys could follow a little later and tell us what title insurance insures.
If not title.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Clear title.
Representative Summer.
Mr. Chair, the good Representative Smith got the answer I was after.
Oh.
Multnomah County.
Okay. Any further questions of Ms. Gonzalez? Seeing that you may stay there if you wish, or you may leave the panel if you wish. And
thank you.
Dave, Harlan, which one of you, whoever, would like to go first?
I can go first, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregon Youth in Action, speaking in support of this bill. The title insurance question of Representative Anderson's, there's an express exclusion in title insurance policies for zoning, any type of zoning decision or any type of or lack thereof. There's a reason why the title insurance policy costs $400 for a property worth $300,000 because it really doesn't cover anything. You pay your $400 to satisfy your mortgage lender, but other than that, you know, the title insurance policies in the years that I was in private practice, we had a number of claims where real estate claims where we tried to loop in the title insurance companies, and of all the claims that we did, I think there was only once where we got a trial judge to say that the title insurance company was liable for the claim, and that was where the title insurance officer had drafted the had prepared the language for the deed on a parcel that should have been square, but when he traced it out, there was a line here and a line here and a line up here, and then it went out that way, and then he never closed the loop. And so, trying to get title insurance companies on the hook for what they cover in their policy is a difficult thing to do, and there's an express exclusion for the zoning ordinances. This is really, I know the focus of this and the discussion has been about Multnomah County, but really we get in our office calls on this issue all the time, and they come from all over the state. This is really a statewide problem, and it really takes, at least based on the calls we get, it takes two forms. The first is where the property owner could have lawfully divided the property, but they didn't go down and submit an application to the local government, and in that case it's hard to pin any blame on the local government because they didn't have any idea that this was happening. But if you're the third or fourth party in the chain, and you know it's been sold and resold and resold, you're an innocent purchaser, and it comes to you find out 20 years later that this property was that the division of this property wasn't done in compliance with the applicable land use ordinance. It could have been done, but it just wasn't. By the statute of ultimate repose, it's too late to go back and go against the owner of the property at the time that could have submitted the application. And the second type is the ones that you've heard here, where the property was divided and it wasn't in compliance with the zoning ordinance or comp plan at the time. But nevertheless, the subsequent purchaser went in and the county issued some type of permit to develop that property. In that case, then there's some culpability, at least it would seem to us, on the part of the local governments at that point. Either situation, however, screams out for some type of solution, legislative solution. The bill, as drafted right now, I don't think does what it is that I don't think it helps the Newberrys. The Newberrys contacted me quite some time ago, and I suggested that they needed a statutory fix. I don't think that the language of this bill, I don't think helps them, because it refers to a legal lot or parcel that was unlawfully divided. Well, if it's unlawfully divided, by definition, it's not a legal lot or parcel. So there's some language fixes here. This is certainly something that we did that, believe me, from landowners around the state, that really needs to be resolved. And we'd love to help get it done.
Any questions of Mr. Hennigan?
Thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. Also here to support this bill, or at least the intentions of this bill. I do agree with Mr. Honeycutt. I'm not sure that the actual words in this bill get to the solution that we need, but I do appreciate Representative Smith bringing this concept forward, because we do find this popping up from time to time in various jurisdictions around the state. We would argue that this is merely a grandfathering bill. I mean, what you have here are existing uses, in many cases existing single-family homes on these illegally created lots, and these folks, you know, are innocent purchasers, and we just need to grandfather them and make them legal, because the fact of the matter is these properties have no value. I mean, if you use the definition of fair market value of being what would a willing buyer pay to a willing seller in an arm's-length transaction, there is no value, because no willing buyer is going to buy one of these illegally created lots. It could be the most beautiful house in the world. If it's not a legal lot of record, it's valueless. I would submit to you that this is an example of some of the inflexibility that has been built into the program over the years. I mean, the fact that we need to come before you to the legislature to fix a problem of this nature should be an indication that something needs to be done. But this is something that we would very much appreciate this legislature taking a look at and finding a solution. There is a provision in statute already. I believe it's either in ORS Chapter 92 or in Chapter 215 that talks about a bank foreclosing a loan on a house in an EFU zone, and then that foreclosure, by virtue of that foreclosure, they can create a lawful lot just by foreclosing a portion of the property. So if you have an 80-acre parcel and the bank forecloses on just the 1 acre where the house is located, you would now have a legal 1-acre parcel and a legal 79-acre parcel. So there is some precedent in law already to allow for this type of thing to happen, but it does require the legislature to weigh in and do something. In response to one of Representative Garrard's questions earlier, what type of seller creates these lots? Well, it's somebody that's doing something illegal. I mean, the bottom line is a lot of these people, either they don't know or they do know and they're doing it maliciously. I remember in law school we used to talk about these people, and they always ended up on the beach in Acapulco kicking back with a pina colada after this transaction had been made, and you could never end up finding them. Because there is a statute that provides for a cause of action for a buyer of one of these parcels to go after the seller. But again, you know, if the buyer is gone, or if the seller is gone, or if it's, you know, a few sales down the chain, that remedy really isn't very much for a buyer.
Harlan, I think it took the committee a little time to discover that everyone who was addressing this issue today was a victim. I was looking for somebody to pin it on, so to speak. Where did the, you know, and it took a little while to understand that everybody here was a victim today.
Chair Garrard, that is the case, exactly. These folks bought homes like we all do and thought they were buying, you know, their American dream, and ended up American nightmare when they found out that it was an unlawfully created lot and that the house had no value. With that, I would conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for either of our panel? Holy cow, you guys are getting off easy. Before you leave, I will ask you and Representative Smith to work on the amendments. Let the chair know when those amendments are ready and that you would like to bring this bill back, and we will do everything we can to move this bill forward and correct this wrong.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3081 and open a work session on House Bill 2705. And I think I need Dave Honeycutt back up here. Dave, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, this bill was heard a couple of weeks back at that point. This is, as I said a couple of weeks ago, this was a bill that came out of this committee 7-0. Last session got sent down to Ways and Means with the fiscal. The speaker kicked the bill out of Ways and Means toward the end of the session, but everybody wanted to go home, and so the bill never moved, which I at that point completely understood. So it's back again. I had suggested some amendments when I testified a couple weeks ago. Representative Ackerman had a couple of suggested amendments. I talked subsequent to that time with the league, they had some suggested amendments, and also with special districts, they had some suggested amendments, and also with the department, with the DLCD, and they had some suggested amendments. I think the dash ones reflect almost all of those amendments. There still will be a disagreement, and I certainly I've never tried to speak for them before, but I think there will be some disagreement on this bill with the DLCD. What the amendments do, essentially, we have removed the language, the reference to alternative or alternate sewage disposal systems in the bill. Those are not defined anywhere. They're not defined in statute. They're not defined in administrative rule. And we didn't want to try and define them in this bill. So the only language left is community sewer system. We've defined that language. That's lines 4-6 of the dash one amendments. We've defined that language to essentially mean that if you've got three or more houses that want to be served by a common sewer system, then that fits with the definition of community sewer system. We then delete the guts of the bill, of the existing bill, which is section 2, and substitute that with the section 2 on lines 9 through 19 of the dash 1 amendments. So sub 1 of section 2 on the dash 1s is the exact same language as sub 1 of the existing bill. Subsection 1B and sub 2 of the existing bill, lines 13 and 14 and 15 on the existing bill, have been deleted and have been replaced with the subsection 2 of section 2 of the dash 1s, which is lines 13 through 19 of the dash 1s, to satisfy the special districts who wanted property owners, if they were within 300 feet of an existing district and they could go into that district, to make application, try and get into that district first before they went out on their own and created their own community sewer system. And then on line 18 of the existing bill, again, we deleted the word alternative sewage disposal system. And then on lines 23 of the existing bill, Representative Ackerman suggested that we broaden the language so that it went beyond the sharing of the cost of the maintenance of the system to also include construction, improvement, or remediation. We added that language pursuant to Representative Ackerman's suggestion. and therefore even further narrowed the bill, which was significantly even further than was done in 2003. What the bill does now is it allows, it doesn't require, but it allows property owners in rural areas to go ahead if there are three or more of them, and they think that it would make sense to have to develop some type of community sewer system to service their three or more homes. It allows them to do that. It doesn't change any of the siting criteria. You still have to meet all of the siting criteria, whatever the rule says. If it's the $80,000 rule on a farm zone, the template dwelling rule in a forest zone, or whatever rule it is in a rural residential zone, you still have to meet all of that to get your home placed there. But if your home's placed there and you and your neighbors want to develop a community sewer to service that, and the DEQ says this makes sense and it's okay, and you're willing to enter into some type of agreement amongst yourselves that the local government can enforce the provisions of your community sewer agreement, then you can go ahead and do so. I don't know how often this will be used, but it certainly seems to me to make both environmental sense and also in some cases where it is used, good sense for the property owners as well. I believe, and I don't know if anybody from the department is sitting behind me that I haven't looked, but I believe their concern predominantly is based on the idea that this would allow community sewer systems in resource zones and farm or forest zones. I guess I understand that, but the siting criteria, the criteria for siting a dwelling don't change. You still got to meet whatever the test is. All this says is if it makes sense to develop community sewer and the DEQ is okay with it, then we gotta allow people to do that. So with that, I'd ask the committee to move the dash ones into the bill, and we certainly support and hope that the committee will forward the bill out with a due pass recommendation.
Any questions of Mr. Honeycutt?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Norman.
Thank you. Mr. Honeycutt, your amendment set a minimum number of properties to participate in one of these community sewer districts, but I don't see a maximum. Is there a practical maximum, or is there a statutory maximum, or anything in rules that sets a maximum?
Chair Garrard, Representative Nolan, there's nothing in rules or statute that would set a maximum. The words community sewer system don't appear in statute. There's they do appear in rules in the unincorporated communities. But NLCDC's unincorporated communities rule, but it doesn't set a maximum either. From a practical purpose standpoint, I think there, you know, at some point there's going to be a maximum. We've got an 80-acre minimum parcel size in this state, and with the difficult dwelling criteria that we have, at least in resource zones, which again I say this in the committee, I think a lot, with 97% of the privately owned land in rural areas being in resource zones, from a practical standpoint, you're going to have very few situations where the cost of developing one of these community sewer systems is going to pencil out. So there won't be very many situations, I think, where this bill is used. There won't be situations where there's a large number of dwellings within an area that's confined enough that it makes economic sense to do so. So I think from a practical standpoint, the answer is yes. From a prohibition standpoint, the answer would be no.
Another question, please.
Another question.
Thank you. I'm trying to understand the language in your amendment, and I am just looking at it now, so I apologize. But your new Section 2 requires that the cluster dwellings approach an adjacent sewer district before developing their own. And it says, but if the provider is unable or unwilling, do the people who want to propose a community sewer district have to accept service from an existing provider
if they are willing to offer it, or is it a discretionary decision on the part of the people who are proposing the community sewer district?
Chair Garrard represented Nolan under the language, and this is language I got straight from, I just inserted straight from the special districts. Under this language, if the district was willing to take you in, the property owners that wanted to establish the community sewer system would have to go into the district rather than developing their own.
Thanks.
Any further questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I think I may have asked this before as I'm reading my notes, but I want to make clear that the cluster dwellings to which you refer in the bill are those which are pre-existing. Is that correct? This is not designed to comply with a cluster of dwellings that would be built in the future.
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, there's nothing in this bill that limits it to dwellings already in existence, but you would still, again, have to meet all of the requirements under existing law to establish one of these
to establish the homes,
at which point you could then go in and develop the community sewer system.
I guess if I could follow up, I read on line 5 that cluster means dwellings that are situated using the present tense. I assume from that you meant that this bill only applies to pre-existing dwellings that form a cluster, not buildings that would be sited in the future or dwellings that would be sited in the future. Am I wrong on that?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, you could certainly read the bill that way. That wasn't our intent, but you may get the Court of Appeals to rule that way. Our idea was that it shouldn't matter whether they're there already or whether they're cited subsequently, as long as they comply with whatever the citing criteria are. If it makes sense to put in a community sewer system and the DEQ is okay with it, then the timing of the dwellings, from our perspective, didn't really make much difference.
My question's answered.
Okay.
Any further questions of Mr. Honeycutt? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Dave. Sam, did we have anyone at any point speak in opposition to this bill?
No, I think the only one was Lane Shadowley from the department, who had, as Mr. Honeycutt said,
some concerns. And those concerns have been taken care of.
I think it's fair to say that there's still some debate on are those concerns adequately addressed or not.
Right.
Okay. Chair would entertain a motion. First on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the amendments 1 to be moved into House Bill 2705.
Representative Anderson has moved the -1 amendments to House Bill 2705. Any discussion? I'm still concerned about the point that I made because as I read it, it's in the present tense, and I thought that only applied to pre-existing dwellings. I did not know that you could use this bill to apply to dwellings that would be cited in the future. So I'm going to be a no at this time, and I'll have to give it some more thought before this bill hits the floor. Okay. Any further discussion?
Just to explain, Mr. Chair, I think the amendments improve the bill, but I'm not sure that they get it all the way to where I think it needs to be. So I'll support the amendments, but I'm not going to support the bill.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Why would it matter if the dwelling was existing or not if we were making a community?
Well, pre-existing, if I could answer that, would certainly limit the scope of the bill to pre-existing dwellings in a cluster. If you say now I can cite a number of dwellings in a cluster, then I can get, it increases the scope of the act, impacts more property, puts more dwellings on maybe farm or forestry property than we would contemplate. I'm wondering why that, you know, if this was written in the present tense, there's no opposition to this, but they may have thought it only applied to pre-existing dwellings in a cluster that wanted to upgrade their sewer systems. That's how I read the bill initially.
I think it's changed, and I'm disappointed that the sponsor says, well, let the Court of Appeals decide that. I think they should be upfront and specific if they mean it only applies to pre-existing dwellings or dwellings to be sited in the future. To the extent they don't make that clear, I have to oppose the bill. I support the
matter. Dave, could you come back up, please?
Is there a way we can make some wording changes in here to relieve the concerns of Representative Ackerman?
Chair, I tried to answer the question that Representative Ackerman posed to me. I don't have any objection to limiting the bill further so that it only applies to existing dwellings. Representative Ackerman's question was that our intent, and the answer to that was, as the bill was drafted and as we proposed it, was no, and that's the answer I gave. If it wants to be further limited, we wouldn't object to that.
Would you still have concerns, Representative Ackerman?
I have concerns the way it's written, and I'm unclear about the answers I've received, so the only remedy for me is to have the bill limited to your pre-existing dwellings.
And Mr. Anacher is indicating he's willing to do that.
Excuse me?
And Mr. Anacher's willing, acknowledging he'd be willing to do that.
I think that would take a minute, though.
Yes, it would.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Miller.
That would alleviate a good bit of my concern as well.
Okay. David, you were Representative Anderson, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I guess I'm questioning why the pre-existing only. Is there a fear that this would create more development in rural areas? Or?
Yes.
And wouldn't that be limited, though, by law, by the zoning?
Yes.
Isn't that a double negative?
No. I think you could cite buildings here that might otherwise not be able to get sewage uses either through a disposal system or through hooking up to a sewage system.
If I might address that.
Follow Mr. Representative Anderson, of course.
Yeah, my concern is that there are some systems now that would make it less expensive for people who run into problems with septic tanks or sand filters, things that generally are used in rural areas, that this could alleviate that problem, especially if they're close. If they're within 300 feet, I certainly agree they hook in with the existing line. If not, some of the new technology might open the future to people having a much more reasonable solution to the problem.
From my point of view, if I might address the question, I think it's fairly substantively changes the, as Representative Ackerman has said, the scope of the legislation. If the bill is aimed at existing dwellings, then from my point of view, it is a mechanism to assist in protecting the groundwaters from existing discharges. And has some substantial benefit for both the community at large and the homeowners who are affected. If, on the other hand, it is extended to supporting new development, it is much broader in scope and has a different intention designed to expand development beyond just protection of existing environmental resources.
But that's what I'm saying, that if there's to be new development, it would have to go through existing zoning laws. Mm-hmm. It's not going to extend a great amount of development if it has to go through the present law. I don't think it really opens up the development. I think it just facilitates what is being developed.
If development law were settled, I think you'd have a stronger point. But this committee over the next 2 months, I presume, is going to be quite actively involved in helping to implement new development law, and therefore I think it is anything but settled right now.
Representative Greenlee.
I'd like to just add to this a little bit. As a public health person, it's never made sense to me not to allow proper sewer and other models for houses that already exist. And I'd really like to help move that forward in a non-controversial way. And if Dave is really amenable to that model, I think we can just move it forward. I mean, get it out of the House, we get it out of the Senate, to deal with the existing problem of houses that are screwing up the environment because we don't let them do what it is they want to do. And I really urge just to move forward in that limited way and let the larger question become a part of all the other issues we're trying to settle. So I would really hope Dave is willing to produce those amendments, and I think we'll be doing some valuable service to the public health of the state by doing that.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if you can do conceptual amendments, but the easy answer to this dilemma is on line 5 of the existing bill and the definition of clustered. You just add the word existing before dwellings. Clustered means that existing dwellings are situated so that establishment and approved community sewer system is practicable. I probably disagree from a policy perspective, but I certainly would, in order to address the concerns with the existing dwellings, it's half a, from our perspective, it's half a loaf, but it's half a loaf we'd be willing to accept.
The bigger. Okay. Well, we've already voted on the dash one amendment, so we're already part of.
We have.
No, we haven't.
I don't think we have.
No, we just had the motion, didn't we?
Oh, that's right.
Can we amend the dash one amendment?
Yes. If you will draw the motion, Representative Anderson.
All right. I'll withdraw the motion to move the dash one amendments into bill, House Bill 2705.
Okay, now we're going to have a motion to verbally amend. We're not supposed to be doing it. Well, you need to tell the committee that, not just me.
Okay. We will say you're not supposed to be doing concept amendments. So even though it's one word, it would be true to the form. As we establish it, would be better to come back with that one word at a future meeting. Even though it may seem nitpicky, it will avoid some of us getting our fingers slapped.
We don't want Sam's fingers slapped, let alone the chair's.
Oh, the chair can have it. It's the staff you have to worry about.
The chair would look for a motion to amend the dash. Actually, we don't need the dash one. You want the dash one still in.
Oh, yeah. You want to add a line to the dash one.
I think we need to come back with work session.
Do you want to draw all rules?
Okay.
Mr. Chair, whatever the committee wants, if the committee, we get dash twos prepared and come back on this if that's what the committee wants. The only difference is to add one word, so I would think that the amendment would be pretty easy to make.
Okay, let's do that. Let's do a dash two.
I have to announce it.
Let me know when you've got them, and then we'll adopt those. Do the bill. Okay, we will close the work session on House Bill 2705 and open a work session on House Bill 3135. And Lisa, I'd just like you to come forward. There are, I think, two or three amendments to this bill, which we've already had a public hearing on. I would like to have the committee have the available time to look at those amendments. So if you could briefly describe what the amendments are to the committee, please.
Thank you very much, Chair Gerard and members of the committee. And I also want to thank those members of the committee that are sponsoring this bill. My name is Lisa Arkin, and I'm a representative of a coalition of residents from Klamath Falls, Colden, and Turner, who support this bill, the Oregon Fair Energy Bill. In the public hearing a few weeks ago, you did hear testimony from residents of those three communities. They discussed their experience in the energy facility siting process and their belief and experience that the local land use planning process had been usurped, and that testimony from residents had been disregarded or disrespected. There were also comments from opponents of the bill, and some of those comments did bring forward what I considered to be an interesting and perhaps legitimate concern, and so I brought forth these amendments to try to address that. And I'd like to tell you the intent of the amendment. First of all, let me just say that with this bill, as it currently stands, an energy facility could receive a site certificate in three different ways. They could receive a site certificate through the expedited review process. And this bill does not touch the expedited review process. That's still in place. And that land use determination is made.
Mrs. Duncan, are the dash one and twos also included in the dash threes?
I have a dash two. I don't have a dash three.
Hmm.
We got all three amendments
delivered at the same time, so we thought all three were from you.
Okay, I'm so sorry, Chair Gerard, maybe I misunderstood.
That's the three.
Oh, thank you.
Surprise, too. So my question is, and it would appear that one and two are a part of three.
Yes, they are. Just as briefly.
Do all committee members have dash threes?
I have
yes.
three. I have two and three. I don't have one.
Well, there
is
one.
Maybe I
can
one has
been incorporated? No, nothing has
been incorporated. From the previous
hearing. I have one and two. That's good.
So we have dash one, twos, and threes, but threes encompass both one and twos. So we're really only dealing with the dash threes at this point.
Okay.
Well, we further complicated this. Nothing's easy in this committee.
Thank you.
I have three.
Now that I'm comparing the dash two and the dash three, I understand now, and if I have your permission to share, what I see is the difference is in the dash two, on the second page line, 22 and 23, it talks about wind power generation, and in the dash three amendments, wind power is left out. Other than that, they're exactly the same.
Thank you
for bearing with me on that. Should I continue?
Yes,
Chair,
please.
Thank you. Okay. So there are three ways to get a site certificate. Very briefly, the expedited review process, which already exists in statute. The local land use decision based on a public hearing to identify substantive state and local land use criteria, and then a determination by the local jurisdiction. And the third way is for determination that the energy facility meets local land use criteria. The last way is for an exception to be taken to local land use criteria, and in order for that to happen, there would be a public hearing, there would be a determination by the local jurisdiction, and then the siting council would take that determination and issue the site certificate. The intent of these amendments, both the dash two and the dash three, was to address what I consider to be legitimate concerns of PG&E and PacifiCorp in their testimony. The amendments lay out a process to give final land use decision making to the siting council in the case of an application for a pipeline, a gas pipeline, or an electrical transmission line, or in the case of the dash two amendments, also a wind generating project. The reason for this is that those types of projects cover a great distance. They go for miles, and they may cross over multiple jurisdictions, and it might make it a little complicated to bring all the players to the final decision making. So this amendment, the intent of it is to establish the special advisory group, which is already in statute, with a representative from each of the impacted jurisdictions, hold those regular public land use hearings, produce a fact-finding report by that special advisory group to the siting council, and then leave the final decision-making up to the siting council to place that pipeline, to place that transmission line, or the larger wind farm. Now, having said that, I must admit that I only saw these amendments when I walked into this room, and I personally feel that they don't say what I just said the intent of the amendments are. I'm not sure how legislative council who worked on this understood the intention of the amendments, but I would say that they're, what you see here is convoluted, and I played with the words as I was sitting there, but...
I think, to get you off the hook here, Lisa, I think probably what we ought to do is give you a few days to take a look at the amendments, and if you wish to have them redrawn in a different fashion, we'd give you time to do that. So,
thank you.
I think that's what we'll do, committee. We won't take any action on this bill now. Lisa, you let me know when you've had an opportunity to look at the amendments, and feel comfortable with whatever you can bring to the committee. Does that sound all right to you?
It sounds wonderful, Chair Gardner. Okay. I thank you.
Thank you. We will close the work session on House Bill 3135. Committee Friday, we will be in Medford, and I will remind you, we are going to try and go down House Bill 2484 in Medford. However, it is a work in progress, believe me. It is the annexation bill, and the Senate version of that bill was pulled back again today for the fourth time. So we are now caught up in somewhat the same entanglements of making sure that we have a bill that, if it moves out, it may be the only bill that moves out. So we'll try to have yet a dash 11 to that bill ready to discuss on Friday night. And we'll remind you that, Sam, you want to review the accommodations, or have all committee members received all the information?
Yes, everybody should know that they're going to be spending the night at the World Regency Inn. We sent a packet. If you don't have it, we can certainly send another one out, and probably should. There is also a reception that's planned at the Red Lion Inn in Medford from 4 to 6 by Tom Hughes and the Oregon Association of Realtors, so they encourage you to be there. In addition to the members of this committee, there will be, five other members who will be joining you as courtesy members that evening.
Representative Spoon.
I just wondered if there was directions, if they'd been sent out.
In the packet that we sent, there was also off of one of the web pages on how to get there.
Did that include from the Red Lion? Because I know originally we had them from...
I think we were saying she did include that, too. So there are several pages of how to get from here to Medford and from the hotel to City Hall.
Be sure you give your cell phone number to all members of the committee.
We want no phone calls that you're lost.
I can get to Medford. I just don't know where the Red Lion is.
Seeing no more, if any committee members have questions, please contact Sam or Lindsay, and we'll take care of your concerns. Seeing no more work before this committee, we'll adjourn the House Committee on Land Use.
And Mr. Chair.